Why don't you blow your nose instead?
I only wanted to ask a question.
Oh, my, she cried in consternation. There goes my cloth.
I'll get it for you.
Jotaro chased down the riverbank after the cloth, then fished it out of the water with his sword.
At least, he reflected, it comes in handy in a situation like this one.
Akemi thanked him and asked what he wanted to know.
Is there a tea house around here called the Yomogi?
Why, yes, it's my house right over there.
Am I glad to hear that. I've spent a long time looking for it.
Why? Where do you come from?
Over that way, he replied, pointing vaguely.
And just where might that be?
He hesitated.
I'm not really sure.
Akemi giggled.
Never mind. But why are you interested in our tea house?
I'm looking for a man named Honiden Matahachi. They told me at the Yoshioka school that if I went to the Yomogi, I'd find him.
He's not there.
You're lying.
Oh, no, it's true. He used to stay with us, but he went off some time ago.
Where to?
I don't know.
But someone at your house must know.
No, my mother doesn't know either. He just ran away.
Oh, no.
The boy crouched down and stared worriedly into the river.
Now what am I supposed to do?
He sighed.
Who sent you here?
My teacher.
Who's your teacher?
His name is Miyamoto Musashi.
Did you bring a letter?
No,
said Jotaro, shaking his head.
A fine messenger you are. You don't know where you came from, and you don't have a letter with you.
I have a message to deliver.
What is it? He may never come back, but if he does, I'll tell him for you.
I don't think I should do that, do you?
Don't ask me. Make up your own mind.
Maybe I should, then.
He said he wanted to see Matahachi very much. He said to tell Matahachi that he'd wait on the great bridge at Gojo Avenue every morning from the first day to the seventh day of the new year. Matahachi should meet him there on one of those days.
Akemi broke into uncontrollable laughter.
I never heard of such a thing. You mean he's sending a message now, telling Matahachi to meet him next year? Your teacher must be as strange as you are.
A scowl came over Jotaro's face, and his shoulders tensed with anger.
What's so funny?
Akemi finally managed to stop laughing.
Now you're angry, aren't you?
Of course I am. I just asked you politely to do me a favor, and you start laughing like a lunatic.
I'm sorry. I really am. I won't laugh anymore. And if Matahachi comes back, I'll give him your message.
Is that a promise?
Yes, I swear.
Biting her lips to avoid smiling, Akemi asked,
What was his name again? The man who sent you with the message?
Your memory is not too good, is it?
His name is Miyamoto Musashi. How do you write Musashi?
Picking up a bamboo stick, Jotaro scratched the two characters in the sand.
Why? Those are the characters for Takezo, exclaimed Akemi.
His name isn't Takezo, it's Musashi.
Yes, but they can also be read Takezo.
Stubborn, aren't you?
Snapped Jotaro, tossing the bamboo stick into the river.
Akemi stared fixedly at the characters in the sand, lost in thought. Finally, she lifted her gaze from the ground to Jotaro, re-examined him from head to toe, and in a soft voice asked,
I wonder if Musashi is from the Yoshino area in Mimasaka.
Yes, I'm from Harima. He's from the village of Miyamoto in the neighboring province of Mimasaka.
Is he tall and manly? And does he leave the top of his head unshaved?
Yes. How did you know?
I remember him telling me once that when he was a child, he had a carbuncle on the top of his head. If he shaved it the way samurai usually do, you would see an ugly scar.
Told you? When?
Oh, it's been 5 years now.
Have you known my teacher that long?
Akemi did not answer. The memory of those days evoked stirrings in her heart that made even speaking difficult. Convinced from the little the boy had said that Musashi was Takezo, she was gripped by a yearning to see him again. She had seen her mother's way of doing things,
and she had watched Matahachi go from bad to worse. From the first, she had preferred Takezo, and had since grown more and more confident in the rightness of his choice. She was glad to be still single. Takezo. He was so different from Matahachi. Many were the times she had resolved to never let herself wind up with the likes of the men who always drank at the tea house. She scorned them, holding on firmly to the image of Takezo. Deep within her heart, she nourished the dream of finding him again. He, only he, was the lover in her mind when she sang love songs to herself. His mission fulfilled, Jotaro said, "Well, I'd better be going now. If you find Matahachi, be sure to tell him what I told you." He hurried off, trotting along the narrow top of the dike. The ox cart was loaded with a mountain of sacks, containing rice, perhaps, or lentil beans, or some other local product. On top of the pile, a plaque proclaimed that this was a contribution being sent by faithful Buddhists to the great Kofukuji in Nara. Even Jotaro knew of this temple, for its name was virtually synonymous with Nara. Jotaro's face lit up with childish joy. Chasing after the vehicle, he climbed up on back. If he faced backward, there was just enough room to sit down. As an added luxury, he had the sacks to lean against. On either side of the road, the rolling hills were covered with neat rows of tea bushes. The cherry trees had begun to bloom, and farmers were plowing their barley, praying, no doubt, that this year it would once again be safe from the trampling feet of soldiers and horses. Women knelt by the streams washing their vegetables. The Yamato High Road was at peace. What luck, thought Jotaro, as he settled back and relaxed. Comfortable on his perch, he was tempted to go to sleep, but thought better of it. Fearing they might reach Nara before he awoke, he was thankful every time the wheels struck a rock and the wagon shook, since it helped him keep his eyes open. Nothing could have given him more pleasure than to be not only moving along like this, but actually heading toward his destination. Outside one village, Jotaro lazily reached out and plucked a leaf from a camellia tree. Putting it to his tongue, he began to whistle a tune. The wagon driver looked back, but could see nothing. Since the whistling went on, he looked over his left shoulder, then his right shoulder several more times. Finally, he stopped the wagon and walked around to the back. The sight of Jotaro threw him into a rage, and the blow from his fist was so sharp the boy cried out in pain.
"What are you doing up there?" he snarled.
"It's all right, isn't it?"
"It is not all right."
"Why not? You're not pulling it yourself."
"You impudent little bastard,"
shouted the driver, tossing Jotaro onto the ground like a ball. He bounced and rolled against the foot of a tree. Starting off with a rumble, the wheels of the wagon seemed to be laughing at him. Jotaro picked himself up and began to search carefully around on the ground. He just noticed he no longer had the bamboo tube containing the reply from the Yoshioka school to Musashi. He had hung it from his neck with a cord, but now it was gone. As the totally distraught boy gradually widened the area of his search, a young woman in traveling clothes, who had stopped to watch him, asked,
"Did you lose something?"
He glanced at her face, which was partially hidden by a broad-brimmed hat, nodded, and resumed his search.
"Was it money?"
Jotaro, thoroughly absorbed, paid little attention to the question, but managed a negative grunt.
"Well, was it a bamboo tube about a foot long with a cord attached?"
Jotaro jumped up. "Yes! How did you know?"
"So it was you the drivers near the Mumpkuji were yelling at for teasing their horse."
Well,
when you got scared and ran, the cord must have broken. The tube fell on the road, and the samurai who'd been talking to the drivers picked it up. Why don't you go back and ask him about it?"
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, of course."
"Thanks." Just as he started to run off, the young woman called after him.
"Wait! There's no need to go back. I can see the samurai coming this way. The one in the field hakama."
She pointed toward the man.
Jotaro stopped and waited, eyes wide. The samurai was an impressive man of about 40. Everything about him was a little bigger than life. His height, his jet-black beard, his broad shoulders, his massive chest. He wore leather socks and straw sandals, and when he walked, his firm footsteps seemed to compact the earth. Jotaro, certain at a glance that this was a great warrior in the service of one of the more prominent daimyo, felt too frightened to address him. Fortunately, the samurai spoke first, summoning the boy.
"Weren't you the imp who dropped this bamboo tube in front of the Mampukuji?"
he asked.
"Oh, that's it! You found it!"
"Don't you know how to say thank you?"
"I'm sorry. Thank you, sir."
"I dare say there's an important letter inside. When your master sends you on a mission, you shouldn't be stopping along the way to tease horses, hitching rides on wagons, or loafing by the wayside."
"Yes, sir."
"Did you look inside, sir?" "It's only natural, when you've found something, to examine it and return it to its owner. But I did not break the seal on the letter. Now that you have it back, you should check and see that it's in good order."
Jotaro took the cap from the tube and peered inside. Satisfied that the letter was still there, he hung the tube from his neck and swore not to lose it a second time. The young woman looked as pleased as Jotaro.
"It was very kind of you, sir," she said to the samurai,
in an attempt to make up for Jotaro's inability to express himself properly. The bearded samurai started walking along with the two of them.
"Is the boy with you?"
he asked her.
"Oh, no. I've never seen him before."
The samurai laughed.
"I thought you made a rather strange pair. He's a funny-looking devil, isn't he? Lodgings written on his hat and all."
"Perhaps it's his youthful innocence that's so appealing. I like him, too."
Turning to Jotaro, she asked,
"Where are you going?"
Walking along between them, Jotaro was once again in high spirits.
"Me? I'm going to Nara, to the Hozoin."
A long, narrow object wrapped in gold brocade and nestled in the girl's obi caught his eye. Staring at it, he said,
"I see you have a letter tube, too. Be careful you don't lose it."
"Letter tube? What do you mean?"
"There, in your obi." She laughed.
"This isn't a letter tube, silly. It's a flute."
"A flute?" Eyes burning with curiosity, Jotaro unabashedly moved his head close to her waist to inspect the object. Suddenly, a strange feeling came over him. He pulled back and seemed to be examining the girl. Even children have a sense of feminine beauty, or at least they understand instinctively whether a woman is pure or not. Jotaro was impressed with the girl's loveliness and respected it. It seemed to him an unimaginable stroke of good luck that he should be walking along with one so pretty. His heart throbbed, and he felt giddy.
"I see. A flute. Do you play the flute, auntie?" he asked.
Then, obviously remembering Akemi's reaction to the word, he abruptly changed his question.
"What's your name?"
The girl laughed and cast an amused glance over the boy's head at the samurai. The bear-like warrior joined in the laughter, displaying a row of strong white teeth behind his beard.
"You're a fine one, you are. When you ask someone's name, it's only good manners to state your own first."
"My name's Jotaro."
This brought forth more laughter.
"That's not fair," cried Jotaro. "You made me tell my name, but I still don't know yours. What's your name, sir?"
"My name's Shoda," said the samurai.
"That must be your family name. What's your other name?"
"I'll have to ask you to let me off on that one."
Undaunted, Jotaro turned to the girl and said,
"Now it's your turn. We told you our names. It wouldn't be polite for you not to tell us yours. Mine is Otsu."
"Otsu?"
Jotaro repeated. He seemed satisfied for a moment, but then chattered on.
"Why do you go around with a flute in your obi?" "Oh, I need this to make my living."
"Are you a flute player by profession?"
"Well, I'm not sure there's any such thing as a professional flute player, But the money I get for playing makes it possible for me to take long trips like this one. I suppose you could call it my profession.
Is the music you play like the music I've heard at Gyeong and the Kamo Shrine? The music for the sacred dances?
No.
Is it like the music for other kinds of dancing? Kabuki, maybe?
No.
Then, what kind do you play?
Oh, just ordinary melodies.
The samurai had meanwhile been wondering about Jotaro's long wooden sword.
What's that you've got stuck in your waist?
He asked.
Don't you know a wooden sword when you see one? I thought you were a samurai.
Yes, I am. I'm just surprised to see one on you. Why are you carrying it?
I'm going to study swordsmanship.
Oh, are you now? Do you have a teacher yet?
I do.
And is he the person to whom the letter is addressed?
Yes.
If he's your teacher, he must be a real expert.
He's not all that good.
What do you mean?
Everybody says he's weak.
Doesn't it bother you to have a weak man for a teacher?
No, I'm no good with a sword either, so it doesn't make any difference.
The samurai could hardly contain his amusement. His mouth quivered as if to break into a smile, but his eyes remained grave.
Have you learned any techniques?
Well, not exactly. I haven't learned anything at all yet.
The samurai's laughter finally burst forth.
Walking with you makes the road seem shorter. And you, young lady, where are you going?
Nara. But exactly where in Nara, I don't know. There's a ronin I've been trying to locate for a year or so, and since I've heard that a lot of them have gathered in Nara recently, I'm planning to go there, though I admit the rumor's not much to go on.
The bridge at Uji came into view. Under the eaves of a tea house, a very proper old man with a large tea kettle was purveying his stock in trade to his customers, who were seated around him on stools. Catching sight of Shoda, he greeted him warmly.
"How nice to see someone from the house of Yagyu," he called. "Come in, come in."
"We'd just like to take a short rest. Could you bring the boy here some sweet cakes?"
Jotaro remained on his feet while his companion sat. To him, the idea of sitting down and resting was a bore. Once the cakes arrived, he grabbed them and ran up the low hill behind the tea house. Otsu, sipping her tea, inquired of the old man,
"Is it still a long way to Nara?"
"Yes, even a fast walker'd probably get no farther than Kizu before sunset. A girl like you should plan to spend the night at Taga or Ide."
Shoda spoke up immediately.
"This young lady has been searching for someone for months. But I wonder, do you think it's safe these days for a young woman to travel to Nara alone with no place to stay in mind?"
The old man grew wide-eyed at the question.
"She shouldn't even consider it," he said decisively.
Turning to Otsu, he waved his hand back and forth before his face and said,
"Give the idea up entirely. If you were sure you had someone to stay with, it'd be a different matter. If you don't, Nara can be a very dangerous place."
The proprietor poured a cup of tea for himself and told them what he knew of the situation in Nara. Most people, it seemed, had the impression that the old capital was a quiet, peaceful place where there were lots of colorful temples and tame deer, a place undisturbed by war or famine. But in fact, the town was no longer like that at all. After the Battle of Sekigahara, nobody knew how many ronin from the losing side had come to hide there. Most of them were Osaka partisans from the Western Army, samurai who now had no income and little hope of finding another profession. With the Tokugawa shogunate growing in power year by year, it was doubtful whether these fugitives would ever again be able to make a living out in the open with their swords. According to most estimates, 120,000 to 130,000 samurai had lost their positions. Being the victors, the Tokugawas had confiscated estates representing an annual income of 33 million bushels of rice. Even if the feudal lords, who had since been allowed to re-establish themselves on a more modest scale, were taken into consideration, at least 80 daimyo, with incomes thought to total 20 million bushels, had been dispossessed. On the basis that for every 500 bushels, 3 samurai had been cut loose from their moorings and forced into hiding in various provinces, and including their families and retainers, the total number could not be less than 100,000. The area around Nara and Mount Koya was full of temples and therefore difficult for the Tokugawa forces to patrol. By the same token, it was an ideal hiding place, and the fugitives moved there in droves.
"Why?" said the old man. "The famous Sanada Yukimura is in hiding at Mount Kudo, and Sengoku Soya is said to be in the vicinity of the Horyuji, and Bandaemon at the Kofukuji. I could name many more."
All these were marked men, who would be killed instantly if they showed themselves. Their one hope for the future was for war to break out again. The old man's opinion was that it wouldn't be so bad if it were only these famous ronin hiding out, since they all had a degree of prestige and could make a living for themselves and their families. Complicating the picture, however, were the indigent samurai who prowled the city's back streets in such straits that they'd sell their swords if they could. Half of them had taken to picking fights, gambling, and otherwise disturbing the peace, in the hope that the havoc they caused would make the Osaka forces rise up and take arms. The once tranquil city of Nara had turned into a nest of desperados. For a nice girl like Otsu to go there would be tantamount to her pouring oil on her kimono and jumping into a fire. The tea house proprietor, stirred by his own recitation, concluded by strongly begging Otsu to change her mind. Now doubtful, Otsu sat silently for a while. If she had had the slightest indication that Musashi might be in Nara, she would not have given danger a second thought. But she really had nothing to go on. She had merely wandered toward Nara, just as she had wandered around to various other places in the year since Musashi had left her stranded at the bridge in Himeji. Shoda, seeing the perplexity on her face, said, "You said your name is Otsu, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Well, Otsu, I hesitate to say this, but why don't you give up the idea of going to Nara and come with me to the Koyagyu fief instead?" Feeling obliged to tell her more about himself and assure her that his intentions were honorable, he continued, "My full name is Shoda Kizaemon, and I'm in the service of the Yagyu family. It happens that my lord, who's now 80, is no longer active. He suffers terribly from boredom. When you said you make your living by playing the flute, it occurred to me that it might be a great comfort to him if you were around to play for him from time to time. Do you think you'd like that?" The old man immediately chimed in with enthusiastic approval.
"You should definitely go with him," he urged. "As you probably know, the old lord of Koyagyu is the great Yagyu Muneyoshi. Now that he's retired, he's taken the name Sekishusai. As soon as his heir, Munenori, lord of Tajima, returned from Sekigahara, he was summoned to Edo and appointed an instructor in the shogun's household. Why, there's no greater family in Japan than the Yagyus. To be invited to Koyagyu is an honor in itself. Please, by all means, accept."
On hearing that Kizaemon was an official in the famous house of Yagyu, Otsu congratulated herself for having guessed that he was no ordinary samurai. Still, she found it difficult to reply to his proposal. Faced with her silence, Kizaemon asked, "Don't you want to come?"
"It's not that. I couldn't wish for a better offer. I'm simply afraid my playing isn't good enough for a great man like Yagyu Muneyoshi."
"Oh, don't give it a second thought. The Yagyus are very different from the other daimyo. Sekishusai, in particular, has the simple, quiet tastes of a tea master.
He would be more upset, I think, by your diffidence than by what you fancy to be your lack of skill.
Otsu realized that going to Koyagyu, rather than wandering aimlessly to Nara, offered some hope, however slight. Since the death of Yoshioka Kenpo, the Yagyus had been considered by many to be the greatest exponents of the martial arts in the country. It was only to be expected that swordsmen from all over the country would call at their gate, and there might even be a registry of visitors. How happy she would be if on that list she found the name of Miyamoto Musashi. With that possibility foremost in mind, she said brightly, "If you really think it's all right, I'll go."
"You will? Wonderful. I'm very grateful." I doubt that a woman could walk all the way there before nightfall. Can you ride a horse?"
"Yes."
Kizaemon ducked under the eaves of the shop and raised his hand toward the bridge. The groom waiting there came running forward with a horse, which Kizaemon let Otsu ride, while he himself walked along beside her. Jotaro spotted them from the hill behind the tea house and called, "Are you leaving already?"
"Yes, we're off."
"Wait for me!" They were halfway across Uji Bridge when Jotaro caught up with them. Kizaemon asked him what he had been up to, and he answered that a lot of men in a grove on the hill were playing some kind of game. He didn't know what game it was, but it looked interesting. The groom laughed.
"That would be the Ronin riffraff having a gambling session. They don't have enough money to eat, so they lure travelers into their games and take them for everything they're worth. It's disgraceful."
"Oh, so they gamble for a living?"
asked Kizaemon.
"The gamblers are among the better ones," replied the groom. "Many others have become kidnappers and blackmailers. They're such a rough lot, nobody can do anything to stop them."
"Why doesn't the lord of the district arrest them or drive them away?"
"There are too many of them, far more than he can cope with. If all the Ronin from Kawachi, Yamato, and Ki joined together, they'd be stronger than his own troops."
"I hear Koga's swarming with them too."
"Yes, the ones from Tsutsui fled there. They're determined to hang on until the next war."
"You keep talking that way about the Ronin," Jotaro broke in, "but some of them must be good men."
"That's true," agreed Kizaemon.
"My teachers are Ronin."
Kizaemon laughed and said,
"So that's why you spoke up in their defense. You're loyal enough. You did say you were on your way to the Hozoin, didn't you? Is that where your teacher is?"
"I don't know for sure, but he said if I went there, they'd tell me where he is."
"What style does he use?"
"I don't know."
"You're his disciple, and you don't know his style?"
"Sir,"
the groom put in,
"swordsmanship is a fad these days. Everybody and his brothers going around studying it. You can meet 5 or 10 wandering on this road alone any day of the week. It's all because there are so many more Ronin around to give lessons than there used to be."
"I suppose that's part of it."
"They're attracted to it because they hear somewhere that if a fellow's good with a sword, the daimyo will fall all over each other trying to hire him for 4 or 5,000 bushels a year."
"A quick way to get rich, huh?"
"Exactly. When you think about it, it's frightening. Why, even this boy here has a wooden sword. He probably thinks he just has to learn how to hit people with it to become a real man. We get a lot like that, and the sad part is, in the end, most of them will go hungry."
Jotaro's anger rose in a flash.
"What's that? I dare you to say that again!"
"Listen to him. He looks like a flea carrying a toothpick, but he already fancies himself a great warrior."
Kizaemon laughed.
"Now, Jotaro, don't get mad, or you'll lose your bamboo tube again."
"No, I won't. Don't worry about me."
They walked on, Jotaro sulking silently, the others looking at the sun as it slowly set. Presently, they arrived at the Kizu River ferry landing.
"This is where we leave you, my boy. It'll be dark soon, so you'd better hurry. And don't waste time along the way."
"Otsu?"
said Jotaro, thinking she would come with him.
"Oh, I forgot to tell you," she said. "I've decided to go along with this gentleman to the castle at Koyagyu."
Jotaro looked crushed.
Take good care of yourself,
Otsu said, smiling.
I should have known I'd wind up alone again.
He picked up a stone and sent it skimming across the water.
Oh, we'll see each other again one of these days. Your home seems to be the road, and I do a bit of traveling myself.
Jotaro didn't seem to want to move.
Just who are you looking for? He asked. What sort of person?
Without answering, Otsu waved farewell. Jotaro ran along the bank and jumped into the very middle of the small ferry boat. When the boat, red in the evening sun, was halfway across the river, he looked back. He could just make out Otsu's horse and Kizaemon on the Kasagi Temple Road. They were in the valley, beyond the point where the river suddenly grows narrower, slowly being swallowed up by the early shadows of the mountain. The Hozoin. Students of the martial arts invariably knew of the Hozoin. For a man who claimed to be a serious student to refer to it as just another temple was sufficient reason for him to be regarded as an impostor. It was well known among the local populace too, though oddly enough, few were familiar with the much more important Shosoin repository and its priceless collection of ancient art objects. The temple was located on Abura Hill in a large, dense forest of cryptomeria trees. It was just the kind of place goblins might inhabit. Here, too, were reminders of the glories of the Nara period, the ruins of a temple, the Ganlin-in, and of the huge public bathhouse built by the Empress Komyo for the poor. But today, all that was left was a scattering of foundation stones peeking out through the moss and weeds. Musashi had no difficulty getting directions to Abura Hill, but once there, he stood looking all around in bewilderment, for there were quite a few other temples nestled in the forest. The cryptomerias had weathered the winter and been bathed in the early spring rains, and their leaves were now at their darkest. Above them, one could make out in the approaching twilight the soft feminine curves of Mount Kasuga. The distant mountains still lay in bright sunlight. Although none of the temples looked like the right one, Musashi went from gate to gate inspecting the plaques on which their names were inscribed. His mind was so preoccupied with the Hozoin that when he saw the plaque of the Ozoin, he at first misread it, since only the first character, that for O, was different. Although he immediately realized his mistake, he took a look inside anyway. The Ozoin appeared to belong to the Nichiren sect. As far as he knew, the Hozoin was a Zen temple having no connection with Nichiren. As he stood there, a young monk returning to the Ozoin passed by him, staring suspiciously. Musashi removed his hat and said, "Could I trouble you for some information?"
"What would you like to know?"
"This temple is called the Ozoin?"
"Yes, that's what it says on the plaque."
"I was told that the Hozoin is on Abura Hill, isn't it?"
"It's just in back of this temple. Are you going there for a fencing bout?"
"Yes."
"Then, let me give you some advice. Forget it."
"Why?"
"It's dangerous. I can understand someone born crippled going there to get his legs straightened out, but I see no reason why anyone with good straight limbs should go there and be maimed."
The monk was well-built and somehow different from the ordinary Nichiren monk. According to him, the number of would-be warriors had reached the point where even the Hozoin had come to regard them as a nuisance. The temple was, after all, a holy sanctuary for the light of the Buddha's law, as its name indicated. Its real concern was religion. The martial arts were only a sideline, so to speak. Kakuzenbo Inge, the former abbot, had often called on Yagyu Muneyoshi. Through his association with Muneyoshi and with Lord Koizumi of Ise, Muneyoshi's friend, he had developed an interest in the martial arts and eventually taken up swordsmanship as a pastime.
From that, he had gone on to devise new ways of using the lance, and this, as Musashi already knew, was the origin of the highly regarded Hozoin style. Inge was now 84 years old and completely senile. He saw almost no one. Even when he did receive a caller, he was unable to carry on a conversation. He could only sit and make unintelligible movements with his toothless mouth. He didn't seem to comprehend anything said to him. As for the lance, he had forgotten about it completely. "And so you see," concluded the monk after explaining all this, "it wouldn't do you much good to go there. You probably couldn't meet the master, and even if you did, you wouldn't learn anything." His brusque manner made it clear that he was eager to be rid of Musashi. Though aware he was being made light of, Musashi persisted. "I've heard about Inge, and I know what you've said about him is true. But I've also heard that a priest named Inshung has taken over as his successor. They say he's still studying but already knows all the secrets of the Hozoin style. According to what I've heard, although he already has many students, he never refuses to give guidance to anyone who calls on him."
"Oh, Inshung," said the monk disdainfully. "There's nothing in those rumors. Inshung is actually a student of the abbot of the Ozoing. After Inge began to show his age, our abbot felt it would be a shame for the reputation of the Hozoing to go to waste, so he taught Inshung the secrets of lance fighting, what he himself had learned from Inge, and then saw to it that Inshung became abbot."
"I see," said Musashi.
"But you still want to go over there?"
"Well, I've come all this distance."
"Yes, of course."
"You said it's behind here. Is it better to go around to the left or to the right?"
"You don't have to go around. It's much quicker just to walk straight through our temple. You can't miss it."
Thanking him, Musashi walked past the temple kitchen to the back of the compound, which, with its woodshed, a storehouse for bean paste and a vegetable garden of an acre or so, very much resembled the area around the house of a well-to-do farmer. Beyond the garden, he saw the Hozoin. Walking on the soft ground between rows of rape, radishes, and scallions, he noticed, off to one side, an old man hoeing vegetables. Hunched over his hoe, he was looking intently at the blade. All Musashi could see of his face was a pair of snow-white eyebrows, and save for the clank of the hoe against the rocks, it was perfectly quiet. Musashi assumed that the old man must be a monk from the Ozoin. He started to speak, but the man was so absorbed in his work that it seemed rude to disturb him. As he walked silently by, however, he suddenly became aware that the old man was staring out of the corner of his eye at Musashi's feet. Although the other man neither moved nor spoke, Musashi felt a terrifying force attack him, a force like lightning splitting the clouds. This was no daydream. He actually felt the mysterious power pierce his body, and, terrified, he leaped into the air. He felt hot all over, as if he'd just narrowly avoided a death blow from a sword or lance. Looking over his shoulder, he saw that the hunched back was still turned toward him, the hoe continuing its unbroken rhythm.
"What on earth was that all about?" he wondered,
dumbfounded by the power he'd been hit with. He found himself in front of the Hozoin, his curiosity unabated. While waiting for a servant to appear, he thought, Inshung should still be a young man. The young monk said Inge was senile and had forgotten all about the lance, but I wonder. The incident in the garden lingered in the back of his mind. He called out loudly two more times, but the only reply was an echo from the surrounding trees. Noticing a large gong beside the entrance, he struck it. Almost immediately, an answering call came from deep inside the temple. A priest came to the door. He was big and brawny. Had he been one of the warrior priests of Mount Hiei,
he might well have been the commander of a battalion. Accustomed as he was to receiving visits from people like Musashi day in and day out, he gave him a brief glance and said,
"You're a shugyosha?"
"Yes."
"What are you here for?"
"I'd like to meet the master." The priest said,
"Come in,"
and gestured to the right of the entrance, suggesting obliquely that Musashi should wash his feet first. There was a barrel overflowing with water supplied by a bamboo pipe and, pointing this way and that, about 10 pairs of worn and dirty sandals. Musashi followed the priest down a wide, dark corridor and was shown into an anteroom. There he was told to wait. The smell of incense was in the air, and through the window he could see the broad leaves of a plantain tree. Aside from the offhand manner of the giant who'd let him in, nothing he saw indicated there was anything unusual about this particular temple. When he reappeared, the priest handed him a registry and inkbox, saying,
"Write down your name, where you studied, and what style you use."
He spoke as though instructing a child. The title on the registry was, "List of Persons Visiting This Temple to Study, Steward of the Hozoin." Musashi opened the book and glanced over the names, each listed under the date on which the samurai or student had called. Following the style of the last entry, he wrote down the required information, omitting the name of his teacher. The priest, of course, was especially interested in that. Musashi's answer was essentially the one he'd given at the Yoshioka school. He had practiced the use of the truncheon under his father without working very hard at it. Since making up his mind to study in earnest, he had taken as his teacher everything in the universe, as well as the examples set by his predecessors throughout the country. He ended up by saying, "I'm still in the process of learning."
You probably know this already, but since the time of our first master, the Hozoin has been celebrated everywhere for its lance techniques. The fighting that goes on here is rough, and there are no exceptions. Before you go on, perhaps you'd better read what's written at the beginning of the registry."
Musashi picked up the book, opened it, and read the stipulation, which he had skipped over before. It said, "Having come here for the purpose of study, I absolve the temple of all responsibility in the event that I suffer bodily injury or am killed." "I agree to that," said Musashi with a slight grin. It amounted to no more than common sense for anyone committed to becoming a warrior.
"All right, this way."
The dojo was immense. The monks must have sacrificed a lecture hall or some other large temple building in favor of having it. Musashi had never before seen a hall with columns of such girth, and he also observed traces of paint, gold foil, and Chinese white primer on the frame of the transom, things not to be found in ordinary practice halls. He was by no means the only visitor. More than 10 student warriors were seated in the waiting area, with a similar number of student priests. In addition, there were quite a few samurai who seemed to be merely observers. All were tensely watching 2 lancers fighting a practice bout. No one even glanced Musashi's way as he sat down in a corner. According to a sign on the wall, if anyone wanted to fight with real lances, the challenge would be accepted, but the combatants now on the floor were using long oak practice poles. A strike could, nevertheless, be extremely painful, even fatal. One of the fighters was eventually thrown in the air, and as he limped back to his seat in defeat, Musashi could see that his thigh had already swollen to the size of a tree trunk. Unable to sit down, he dropped awkwardly to one knee and extended the wounded leg out before him.
"Next!"
came the summons from the man on the floor, a priest of singularly arrogant manner. The sleeves of his robe were tied up behind him, and his whole body, legs, arms, shoulders, even his forehead, seemed to consist of bulging muscles. The oak pole he held vertically was at least 10 feet in length. A man who seemed to be one of those who'd arrived that day spoke up. He fastened up his sleeves with a leather thong and strode into the practice area. The priest stood motionless as the challenger went to the wall, chose a halberd, and came to face him. They bowed, as was customary, but no sooner had they done this than the priest let out a howl like that of a wild hound, simultaneously bringing his pole down forcefully on the challenger's skull.
"Next!"
he called, reverting to his original position. That was all. The challenger was finished. While he did not appear to be dead yet, the simple act of lifting his head from the floor was more than he could manage. A couple of the student priests went out and dragged him back by the sleeves and waist of his kimono. On the floor behind him stretched a thread of saliva mixed with blood.
"Next!"
shouted the priest again, as surly as ever. At first, Musashi thought he was the second-generation master, Inshun, but the men sitting around him said no, he was Agong, one of the senior disciples who were known as the Seven Pillars of the Hozoin. Inshun himself, they said, never had to engage in a bout because challengers were always put down by one of these.
"Is there no one else?"
bellowed Agong, now holding his practice lance horizontally. The brawny steward was comparing his registry with the faces of the waiting men. He pointed at one.
"No, not today. I'll come again some other time."
"How about you?"
"No, I don't feel quite up to it today."
One by one, they backed out, until Musashi saw the finger pointing at him.
"How about you?"
"If you please."
"If you please? What's that supposed to mean?"
"It means I'd like to fight."
All eyes focused on Musashi as he rose. The haughty Agong had retired from the floor and was talking and laughing animatedly with a group of priests, but when it appeared that another challenger had been found, a bored look came over his face, and he said lazily,
"Somebody take over for me."
"Go ahead," they urged. "There's only one more." Giving in, Agong walked nonchalantly back to the center of the floor. He took a fresh grip on the shiny black wooden pole with which he seemed totally familiar. In quick order, he assumed an attacking stance, turned his back on Musashi, and charged off in the other direction.
"Yeah!"
Screaming like an enraged rock, he hurtled toward the back wall and thrust his lance viciously into a section used for practice purposes. The boards had been recently replaced, but despite the resilience of the new wood, Agon's bladeless lance plowed straight through.
"Yow!"
His grotesque scream of triumph reverberated through the hall as he disengaged the lance and started to dance, rather than walk, back toward Musashi, steam rising from his muscle-bound body. Taking a stance some distance away, he glared at his latest challenger ferociously. Musashi had come forward with only his wooden sword and now stood quite still, looking a little surprised.
"Ready!"
cried Agong. A dry laugh was heard outside the window, and a voice said,
"Agong, don't be a fool. Look, you stupid oaf, look! That's not a board you're about to take on."
Without relaxing his stance, Agong looked toward the window.
"Who's there?"
he bellowed. The laughter continued, and then there came into view above the windowsill, as though it had been hung there by an antique dealer, a shiny pate and a pair of snow-white eyebrows.
"It won't do you any good, Agong. Not this time. Let the man wait until the day after tomorrow, when Inshun returns."
Musashi, who had also turned his head toward the window, saw that the face belonged to the old man he had seen on his way to the Hozoin, but no sooner had he realized this than the head disappeared. Agon heeded the old man's warning to the extent of relaxing his hold on his weapon, but the minute his eyes met Musashi's again, he swore in the direction of the now empty window and ignored the advice he had received. As Agon tightened his grip on his lance, Musashi asked, for the sake of form, "Are you ready now?" This solicitude drove Agong wild. His muscles were like steel, and when he jumped, he did so with awesome lightness. His feet seemed to be on the floor and in the air at the same time, quivering like moonlight on ocean waves. Musashi stood perfectly still, or so it seemed. There was nothing unusual about his stance. He held his sword straight out with both hands, but being slightly smaller than his opponent and not so conspicuously muscular, he looked almost casual. The greatest difference was in the eyes. Musashi's were as sharp as a bird's, their pupils a clear coral tinted with blood. Agon shook his head, perhaps to shake off the streams of sweat pouring down from his forehead, perhaps to shake off the old man's warning words. Had they lingered on? Was he attempting to cast them out of his mind? Whatever the reason, he was extremely agitated. He repeatedly shifted his position, trying to draw out Musashi, but Musashi remained motionless. Agon's lunge was accompanied by a piercing scream. In the split second that decided the encounter, Musashi parried and counterattacked. What happened? Agon's fellow priests hastily ran forward and crowded around him in a black circle. In the general confusion, some tripped over his practice lance and went sprawling. A priest stood up, his hands and chest smeared with blood, shouting, "Medicine! Bring the medicine! Quick!"
"You won't need any medicine."
It was the old man, who had come in the front entrance and quickly assessed the situation. His face turned sour.
"If I'd thought medicine would save him, I wouldn't have tried to stop him in the first place. The idiot!"
No one paid any attention to Musashi. For lack of anything better to do, he walked to the front door and began putting his sandals on. The old man followed him.
"You!"
he said. Over his shoulder, Musashi replied, "Yes?"
"I'd like to have a few words with you. Come back inside."
He led Musashi to a room behind the practice hall, a simple, square cell, the only opening in the four walls being the door. After they were seated, the old man said,
"It would be more proper for the abbot to come and greet you, but he's on a trip and won't be back for 2 or 3 days. So I'll act on his behalf."
"This is very kind of you," said Musashi, bowing his head. "I'm grateful for the good training I received today, but I feel I should apologize for the unfortunate way it turned out."
"Why? Things like that happen. You have to be ready to accept it before you start fighting. Don't let it worry you."
"How are Agon's injuries?"
"He was killed instantly," said the old man.
The breath with which he spoke felt like a cold wind on Musashi's face.
"He's dead?"
To himself, he said, "So it's happened again." Another life cut short by his wooden sword. He closed his eyes and in his heart called on the name of the Buddha, as he had on similar occasions in the past.
"Young man."
"Yes, sir."
"Is your name Miyamoto Musashi?"
"That's correct."
"Under whom did you study the martial arts?"
"I've had no teacher in the ordinary sense. My father taught me how to use the truncheon when I was young. Since then, I've picked up a number of points from older samurai in various provinces. I've also spent some time traveling about the countryside, learning from the mountains and the rivers. I regard them, too, as teachers."
"You seem to have the right attitude, but you're so strong. Much too strong."
Believing he was being praised, Musashi blushed and said,
"Oh, no. I'm still immature. I'm always making blunders."
"That's not what I mean. Your strength is your problem. You must learn to control it. Become weaker."
"What?"
Musashi asked perplexedly.
"You will recall that a short while ago you passed through the vegetable garden where I was at work."
"Yes."
"When you saw me, you jumped away, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"Why did you do that?"
"Well, Somehow I imagined that you might use your hoe as a weapon and strike my legs with it. Then, too, though your attention seemed to be focused on the ground, my whole body felt transfixed by your eyes. I felt something murderous in that look, as though you were searching for my weak spot so as to attack it. The old man laughed.
It was the other way around. When you were still 50 feet from me, I perceived what you call something murderous in the air. I sensed it in the tip of my hoe. That's how strongly your fighting spirit and ambition manifest themselves in every step you take. I knew I had to be prepared to defend myself. If it had been one of the local farmers passing by, I myself would have been no more than an old man tending vegetables. True, you sensed belligerence in me, but it was only a reflection of your own.
So Musashi had been right in thinking, even before they first exchanged words, that here was no ordinary man. Now he keenly felt that the priest was the master, and he the pupil. His attitude toward the old man with the bent back became appropriately deferential. I thank you for the lesson you have given me. May I ask your name and your position in this temple?
Oh, I don't belong to the Hozoin. I'm the abbot of the Ozoin. My name is Nikkang.
I see.
I'm an old friend of Inge, and since he was studying the use of the lance, I decided to study along with him. Later, I had an afterthought or two. Now, I never touch the weapon.
I guess that means that Inshin, the present abbot here, is your disciple.
Yes, it could be put that way. But priests shouldn't have any use for weapons, and I consider it unfortunate that the Hozoin has become famous for a martial art rather than for its religious fervor. Still, there were people who felt that it would be a pity to let the Hozoin style die out, so I taught it to Inshin, and to no one else.
I wonder if you'd let me stay in your temple until Inshin returns.
Do you propose to challenge him?
Well, as long as I'm here, I'd like to see how the foremost master uses his lance. Nikkan shook his head reproachfully.
It's a waste of time. There's nothing to be learned here.
Is that so?
You've already seen the Hozoin lancemanship just now when you fought Agong. What more do you need to see? If you want to learn more, watch me. Look into my eyes.
Nikkan drew up his shoulders, put his head slightly forward, and stared at Musashi. His eyes seemed about to jump from their sockets. As Musashi stared back, Nikkan's pupils shone first with a coral flame, then gradually took on an azure profundity. The glow burned and numbed Musashi's mind. He looked away. Nikkan's crackling laugh was like the clatter of bone-dry boards. He relaxed his stare only when a younger priest came in and whispered to him.
"Bring it in,"
he commanded. Presently, the young priest returned with a tray and a round wooden rice container, from which Nikkan scooped rice into a bowl. He gave it to Musashi.
"I recommend the tea gruel and pickles. It's the practice of the Hozoin to serve them to all those who come here to study, so don't feel they're going to any special trouble for you. They make their own pickles, called Hozoin pickles, in fact. Cucumbers stuffed with basil and red pepper. I think you'll find they taste rather good."
As Musashi picked up his chopsticks, he felt Nikkan's keen eyes on him again. He could not tell at this point whether their piercing quality originated within the priest or was a response to something he himself emitted. As he bit into a pickle, the feeling swept over him that Takuan's fist was about to smite him again, or perhaps the lance near the threshold was about to fly at him.
After he had finished a bowl of rice mixed with tea and two pickles, Nikan asked,
"Would you care for another helping?"
"No, thank you. I've had plenty."
"What do you think of the pickles?"
"Very good. Thank you."
Even after he'd left, the sting of the red pepper on Musashi's tongue was all he could recall of the pickle's flavor.